So there's a lot more that could be said about the text itself, but I'll leave you to find out for yourself if you so decide. And 10 minutes or so on Vasubandhu. So there's a bit of controversy about when he lived, but it seems like it's settling into he lived in the 4th century Christian era, so 300 and something or other. His father was a Brahmin. Seems like his father's probably a court priest on a small borderland kingdom, and seems to have been, it's a bit of a backwater. Actually, Gandhara, which by that time, I mean, had been the centre of a big empire and also a centre of a lot of Buddhist learning, is a bit of a backwater politically and culturally, but still prosperous. So it wasn't a bad place to be. And then Vasubandhu's mum is said to have exhorted him. Oh, I got it here. Oh, I've come away without the actual quote, but it was something along the lines of, "Look, son, really, you're cut out for something better than a householder's life. Don't go down that avenue. Don't do that. I want you to practice the Dharma. I want you to really commit yourself to practicing the Dharma." So his mum said, words like that. You can imagine saying that to a modern teenager and what their response might be. "Oh, right, mum. Cool." Probably not. More likely, you know, "Am I bothered?" As if. Whatever the current phases are. They're probably rather old-fashioned ones. But anyway, Vasubandhu didn't respond to that. He took it to heart and he became ordained into the Srivastavadin order. So the Srivastavans, they had flourished in this part of India for about 200 years, actually, previous to him joining them. They were eminent scholars. They systematised the texts and the books. And one thing I read about them said they attempt to systemise everything of importance in Buddhist theory and practice. And Vasubandhu was dead impressed. And he became very, very good at it. And they produced a vast, you know, text on this great enterprise of systematising everything. And in particular, because they were out of the Abhidharma tradition, what they were systematising was one's mental states. They were trying to get it really, really precise so that you could reflect on which mental states were present at any given time, reflect on their impermanence, see through to their insubstantiality. And so it was a great enterprise that they were a part of. They weren't the only people doing it, but they were part of it. And at one point they produced a vast work, which what I was reading described as apparently being like a committee report, but had been chaired by a very famous scholar called Vasumitra. And many of the views of the Srivastavadins actually were quite advanced and subtle. So they, for example, they described time. They said time's not real in the way that we think it is. It's not real in itself. It's just our name for a flow of conditioned events. So there's a lot of subtlety in their thoughts. But by the time Vasubandhu was alive and joining them, get ordained into them, dogmatism had crept in. And in particular ways. So their approach of asserting that everything exists had become that all dharmas exist. Well, that was all right, but they added in, there was no sense of a self, so self didn't exist inherently, but there was inherent existence in the Dharma, so something had crept in. They'd veered from subtlety, the subtlety of conditioned co-production, they'd veered away from that subtlety onto a fairly, well, still subtle, but subtle eternalism. And that had happened by the time Vasubandhu arrived. So by the time he entered the order, their teachings were he was impressed with their all-encompassing structure of the mind, and he was impressed with it for some time. But later on, he started to have doubts that this great, you know, elaboration of the Buddha's teaching might be built on the sands of an eternalist wrong view. So he decided to go to Kashmir to study, because that's where the greatest scholars of his day, the greatest Sarvastivadin scholars of his day, lived. Now there was a problem here, because the Kashmiri Sarvastivadins were very orthodox in their views, and they rather looked down on the Gandharans as being not quite up to it. So he knew that they would probably just distrust him if he went there openly as from Gandhara. So he entered Kashmir under a false name. He's even said to have entered under the guise of being a lunatic. He posed as a madman. Now at the time, madmen, madwomen were able to roam about at will. Actually, people, we'd give them food and support, you know, in the villages, so they would roam around at will. So he posed as a madman to get into Kashmir, once he got there, he studied there for, he presumably dropped the role as madman, but he studied for 4 years, but he became frustrated with the dogmatism that he met, and he started to write his own refutations of their teachings. This did not go down well. And he decided to go home to Gandhara, though again he had to pretend he was mad in order to get past the border guards, apparently. So there's lots of little, if you go into the history of him, there's lots of little details like that. So he went home. By this time he wasn't really actively involved in the Sarvastivadin order. And he supported himself by lecturing on Buddhism before the general public. You know, I mean, these days he'd probably get commissioned to produce a Radio 4 series. You'll see something like that, or BBC 4, be Radio 4. Because we know how good that is. You can imagine doing Radio 4 doing a series on the Sarvastivadin doctrine, couldn't you? You know. So each day he composed, he lectured each day. He was given gifts of, you know, money and support in kind by people who, because he was getting quite famous by this time. But at the end of each day, he summed up his teaching in a verse. And one version of the story was the verse was then inscribed on a copper plate, hung on an elephant's head, and then Bazubandhu, beating a drum, challenged anyone to refute the verse. So he's basically, but actually what he was doing was, he created a collection of about 600 verses where he outlined the entire system that he'd studied in Kashmir. So it's that text is still, we've still got versions of it. It's called the Abhidharma Kosha. So it's his condensation, summary of the Abhidharma, Sarvastivadin Abhidharma. He sent that, presumably on an elephant, with a lot of gold as a gift to his teachers in Kashmir. So they were dead pleased, because they thought, all good, Vasubandhu's come over to our side. Look, he's written this great work for us. He's summarised our teachings, and he's written it all down. That's fantastic. Although they were a bit puzzled by his frequent use of terms, of phrases such as, so it is claimed, or so they say. So they were also puzzled by the brevity of the verses. Basically, it was too succinct for them to really get understand, although it was their own teaching. So they sent back his gold, added more gold, and said, would you please write us a commentary on your work? So during the entire time he'd been giving these lectures and working on the Abhidharma Kosha, his real project was going on in parallel, which was a critique of the Sarvastivadin doctrine and its dogmatism. So he was doing both at the same time. So once he got all the gold back, he used the Kashmiri money to publish his critique, and then he sent it back to them. So needless to say, their opinion of him changed completely, because he basically refuted the whole thing. They were furious, and he was described as that apostate, that subscriber to theories that please only fools, and the man whose theories have the coherence of a madman in a fever dream. So they weren't happy. They weren't happy. So, Vasubandhu, still at a fairly early age, I mean 30s, 40s maybe, had achieved quite a lot of notoriety, and his book, The Critique, became standard for unorthodox Buddhists in India of his time. He went against this. Basically, he went against the establishment of his time. Well, he went with it, was impressed with it for a while, but then actually applying his own, obviously rather brilliant mind to it, actually saw its faults, refuted them, and did that brilliantly. So he was going against the establishment of his time. And yeah, gained the notoriety. He travelled, after that, he travelled a lot around, from place to place, teaching. And at a certain point, settled in a town called Ayodhya, which was the centre of Gupta kingdom, empire teaching and learning. And was once city where the Gupta court became established. So now another influence arises. This is his brother, Asanga. Might be his half-brother. Asanga had become convinced by the Mahayana. He'd lived in a cave in a forest for 12 years. There's lots of stories about him. He'd produced some very long, extensive treatises on the Yogacara school, particularly. Vasubandhu wasn't very impressed by that either. He's obviously a hard man to impress, in a certain way. And he said at one point, "Alas, Asanga, residing in the forest, has practiced meditation for 12 years without having attained anything by this meditation. He's founded a system and concocted fantastic writings so difficult and burdensome that they can only be carried along by an elephant." Asanga heard about this and sent some of his pupils to see Vasubandhu. And the first thing they did, one pupil recited a perfection of wisdom text about the absence of own being, absence of self, in all events and persons. Vasubandhu was impressed. Of course, because by that time it accorded with his own kind of state that he'd worked to for himself with respect to opposing the Svastavadins. It accorded with that. But then he was coming in contact with this, you know, big corpus of teachings that were saying the same thing. So he was impressed by the principles of the Mahayana, but said, "That's fantastic, but doesn't seem to have actual practices to do." So then Asanga sent another disciple who recited the Dasabhumika Sutra, which describes the path of the Bodhisattva and what you practice. Vasubandhu so regretted, heard this, and so regretted his previous statements that he wanted to cut out his own tongue. Anyway, Asanga's disciples persuaded him not to do that, but said, "Go and see Asanga and talk to him." So then it said Vasubandhu grasped the meaning of the Mahayana and of within that Nagarjuna's text. So Nagarjuna predated both of Asanga and Vasubandhu, and Asanga's own teachings. He grasped them immediately and started to ask further questions, which Asanga at the time said he couldn't answer. But he urged Vasubandhu to just use his superior understanding to study, interpret the Mahayana and spread it. So, and that's what Vasubandhu proceeded to do. He read his way, first of all, he read his way through every perfection of wisdom text he could find, all texts by Nagarjuna that he could find available to him, and he does seem to have been overwhelmed just by their brilliance and spiritual genius. And after that, assimilating those, he started to write himself. He was asked to be a tutor to the crown prince of the Gupta emperor. He got a lot of money. He was given a lot of money, which he then gave away. He used it to build monasteries, including a monastery for nuns. He built hospitals. There's one text, which I haven't seen myself, but I've read an account of it. There's one text where he describes his just being overwhelmed with compassion, seeing a baby being born. So it's compassion for the situation and the pain involved for the mother, but also the trauma involved for the child. So you get this, it's another example of just very kind of human and deeply felt sympathy and compassion. So he built hospitals, that's partly one reason why he decided to do that. He built schools, he built rest houses, he intervened to help in a big fire that broke out in the land. There was an epidemic at one point, and he immediately went to where that was with a lot of resources to try and help. And in old age, he took to wandering again, apparently. And that was when he wrote his last works on Yogacara. There's a text called 20 Verses, another one called 30 Verses. That's when he wrote those later on. So Indians, both the Indian tradition and the Chinese tradition, and even in the Japanese tradition, they all regard Vajrabandhu as a bodhisattva. They all refer to him as Bodhisattva Vajrabandhu. And the text that I've been referring to in gaining that this sort of biography says, well, maybe that, the fact that Indians, Chinese, Japanese Buddhists and tradition all revere him in that way, maybe that says the most important thing about him. And as to whether or not this is a work of spiritual genius or not, well, read it. Get a copy and read it and make your mind up. I'm beginning to change my mind. Thank you very much.